There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. With me, my guest today is Christo Liebenberg, the president of LIS Technologies, LIS Technologies, a company that is not very well known, but it's got some really exciting ways to separate U-235 from U-238 and increase the concentration of the U-235, what we all call enrichment. Christo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rod. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. And I know a little bit about the LIS story because I think I talked to you guys back when you were a group of about three people with a really interesting set of lasers and other equipment locked up in a storage unit. And you were trying to figure out how to recover what was an amazingly productive technology that became available just as the U.S. kind of moved away from advanced nuclear development in the early 1990s. So tell us a little bit about how did you move from that group of people to where you are now, a team of maybe 30 people, two locations, you own your own island. It's, what a story.
It's been an absolute wild ride for us. Man, I still have to pinch myself to see how quickly we have moved. But yeah, we've got a very, very hot technology here, enriching uranium with lasers. It's called laser enrichment or laser isotope separation. I personally have been doing this my entire career since I was like in my 20s. And there's different types of laser enrichment out there, AVLIS, and there's MLIS, and then there's CRISLOT. CRISLOT is the technology that we are developing. And it's been around, laser enrichment has been around for 55 years. It started in 1971 at Los Alamos National Labs. And since then, 26 countries have tried to do laser enrichment of uranium. And it works in the lab. All works fine, all good. But the scaling has been a showstopper. The scaling challenges have proven to be enormous with these laser systems. So we are taking a different approach with CRISLA. The technology works. It's been demonstrated in the early 90s. I can talk about that, the situation around that. But we are using the latest laser technology, industrial lasers. In fact, the same type of lasers that used in the automotive industry for sheet metal cutting, welding, and drilling. That's the sort of lasers that we are marrying with this CRISLA technology. And we think we've got a real shot at becoming the world's first laser enrichment commercial operation. We had our humble beginnings with Dr. Jeff Eerkens, who is the inventor of this technology. He's based in Northern California, near Davis, California. So we set up shop there 2.5 years ago, and we rented a small building, and that's where we then took out all these equipment that's been in storage. It's been in storage for 30 years, since 1993 till 2023. We took it out of storage and realized that there's very little of that we can use. However, all his documentation and all his papers and all his data was still intact. He saved all of that. And the lasers themselves was in bad shape, but we were able, you know, we took it out and we started refurbishing them. New optics, new power supply, new seals. And today those lasers are running beautifully. They are literally producing twice as much power as it produced back in the 90s. So this technology was indeed demonstrated in the early 90s. It showed that it has a high enough selectivity and produced a high enough enrichment factor where natural uranium would be enriched from natural uranium at 0.7% all the way to LEU levels, about 5% in one step. in one stage. So that was demonstrated in the early 90s. And but then it got shelved. And I can give you a little bit of background. Why was it shelved? You know, Russia or the Soviet Union in the Cold War was a big producer, especially Russia. It was a huge producer of enriched uranium, right, for their nuclear warheads. But then the Iron Curtain came down, and the world markets opened up to Russia, and they decided to downblend, to decommission their nuclear warheads with an agreement with the U.S., decommission those nuclear warheads under the megatons to megawatts program. And they decommissioned the equivalent of 20,000 nuclear warheads, downblended that highly enriched uranium to about 5%, from 90% down to about 5%, and shipped it to the U.S. And here in the U.S., we've been using Russian nuclear fuel for the last 30 years. It's ongoing still today as we speak. We are importing Russian nuclear fuel. Of course, it's a situation that we can no longer tolerate, especially after they invaded Ukraine.
I'm going to break you for a
So,
second.
yeah.
Now, the Russian enriched uranium we're still using today is not from the megatons to megawatts program. I think
Correct.
that program lasted 20 years. And for that 20-year period, 10%, one out of every 10 light bulbs operating in the US was from Russian decommissioned nuclear warheads.
Isn't that amazing?
But it made it so that nobody really wanted to spend any time or money enriching uranium in the US because there was no, I mean, there was the market was pretty flooded.
Right. Yep. When they started flooding the market, it crashed the price of enriched uranium by a factor 2.5, and a lot of the companies decided why develop this technology, right? And so not only did it cause the Chrysler process from Jeff Eriksson at that time to be shelved, a lot of other technology got shelved. In fact, the entire U.S. nuclear industry got shelved. It's the whole fuel supply chain got decimated by that decision, us becoming dependent on that Russian fuel. And you're right, in 2013 it stopped, that megatons and megawatts stopped, but we still continued to import Russian fuel, right? And then in 2024, President Biden signed into law the Prohibiting Russian Enriched Uranium Act was signed into law, which gives us a few more years up till the end of 2027. But by the beginning of 2028, we need to be independent and move away from Russian nuclear fuel. And that's why the DOE, the US government and the DOE, has decided to stimulate and to invest billions of dollars into the nuclear fuel supply chain in the US so we can break the dependence of Russian fuel. And that's where we find
So
ourselves.
I'm gonna go back and ask another question that because this is way out of sequence, but that's okay. I'm curious. You mentioned that your technology, Chrysler, has demonstrated that it can go from 0.7% to roughly 4 to 5% in a single stage. What's the comparison? How many stages of centrifuges does it take to get from that natural level up to LEU,
Right.
commercial
So a
LEU?
centrif you're right. If you look at the single stage enrichment factor for centrifuges, it's at best about 1.25, probably more realistically 1.2 or even less. So that 0.7% can only be increase in enrichment factor by factors, let's say, of 1.2 or 20% per stage. You need dozens of those stages to get it all the way up to about 5% if you do the math. So it takes many, many stages to get it up there. And then you also want to strip. You want to make sure that you don't leave a lot behind, a lot of, uranium-235 in your tailings. So there are also stripping stages to extract that U-235. So it's just many, much more centrifuges that's required, dozens required, compared to a single laser system that we use.
Okay. All right, now you can
And
go on with what where you were going.
right, so yeah, so it got shelved, and the government, the U.S. government, and the DOE decided to stimulate and to invest into the U.S. nuclear fuel industry. They selected six companies to produce our nation's future enriched uranium. LIS Technologies was selected as one of those six. Of those six, four out of six are all centrifuge companies, and two of them are laser enrichment companies, one of them being Global Laser Enrichment. I was at GLE there. I spent six years in total at GLE as their laser manager. And the other one, the sixth one that was selected then, was obviously LIS Technologies. But we have the unique position that LIS Technologies is the only U.S. origin laser enrichment technology in the U.S.
Yeah, GLE traces back to Silex out of Australia, right?
Correct. Silex is the technology behind GLE, and Chrysla is the technology behind LIS Technologies.
Now, what does Chrysla stand for?
So Chrysla stands for condensation repression isotope selective laser activation. So there's a
Wow,
lot
that's a
of words
mouthful.
in there. Yeah, it's a mouthful, and but that's really, what we do. So basically, how laser enrichment works in general, you've got the two isotopes of uranium, the two main isotopes, uranium-235 and uranium-238. The 235 constitutes only 0.7% of all that of the natural abundance. 99.3% of that is uranium-238. It's only the uranium-235 that's fissile, that would that you can use in a nuclear power plant. If you take that 0.7% and you increase it to 5%, that 5% is called low-enriched uranium, or LEU. That's the grade needed for your standard light water reactors. We have 94 of those reactors currently operating in the U.S. If you enrich it beyond 5%, from 5% to 10%, and that can easily be done with our crystal process, you just need a second stage. You have to re-enrich your 5% to a higher level. You can go from 5% to 10% in two stages. That region up to 10% is called LEU. The region between 5% and 10% is called LEU plus. LEU plus. And then the area between the region between 10% and 20% is called HALEU, high-assay low-enriched uranium. That is the enrichment grade needed for all these advanced reactors, such as small modular reactors and micro reactors. They need essentially a HALEU. And again, we can do that in two stages.
Getting to HALEU would be three stages, right? From
Getting
natural
to
to LEU, from LEU to LEU plus, and then from LEU plus to HALEU.
In
Is that
fact,
right? Or...
we can do up to 20% even in two stages.
Okay.
Yep. The enrichment factor is called the beta factor, the beta or beta. So for centrifuges, it's typically around 1.2. It's essentially a multiplication factor. It's by how much that you enrich it from your relative to the feed. So centrifuge is typically about 1.25 per stage. With Chrysla, it's been demonstrated that it can do. It has enrichment factor of 6.7. So you multiply
Wow.
6.7 by the feed of 0.7, you get very close to 5% in one stage. If you take that 5% and you enrich it by a further factor of 6.7, you are well over 20%. So the challenge is actually how to, it's almost like you have to rein it back in a little bit to stay below 20%. We have ways to do that. It's easy to bring it back, right? It's to just detune some parameter to get it back to
Course.
less than 20%.
Of course, one of the challenges you guys are going to have is that your process seems almost too efficient.
That's the beauty of laser enrichment in general. It is that's exactly the beauty, but that's also exactly the proliferation concern, that it's so efficient that you can, make HALEU in two stages and highly enriched uranium in three stages, right? So how do you ensure that you do not exceed 20%? How do you ensure that you use this beautiful technology only for peaceful applications? So that's why we are in constant communication with the NNSA, the Nuclear Security, the National Nuclear Security Administration, and to ensure, and one of the things that we have offered is that we can actually, with our analytical techniques, our mass spectrometers, we can hook that online and have a secure link directly to the IAEA headquarters in Vienna, Austria. So they can monitor that we do not exceed 20%. And they love this idea that they can actually monitor our process and make sure that we use this only for LEU plus or HALEU.
Yeah, as I understand it from the non-proliferation community, the big thing they need to do is be able to absolutely reliably count the material and make sure that they can account for every bit that goes in and out and know exactly where the fissile material ends up. So it sounds like
Correct.
you've got some already in, you're already from the very beginning starting to include safeguards as part of your design. Is that safeguards by
Yep.
design is a phrase that I hear many times from that community. So you guys are
Right.
involved in them
Yes,
from the
very
very
much.
beginning, right?
From the very beginning, the Nuclear Regulatory Council, the NRC, regulates, that's the federal regulator for, when you enrich uranium on a large scale. If you enrich uranium on a very small scale, you can get a state license. Now, Tennessee is an agreement state, and they've got an agreement with the NRC that we can enrich uranium as long as it is just for experimentation. There's a certain limit of so many grams of, uranium that you can use in your process. So right now we do have a radiological material license from the state of Tennessee that allows us to do research on small quantities of uranium. As for the larger quantities, of course, we are already preparing for a commercial facility. The license application and the licensing process for that can take years. So we have an entire licensing team, people that spend their entire careers at the NRC, that's part of the LIST team, busy writing those licenses and preparing those licenses. Part of that license preparation is indeed the whole safety basis. It consists of an integrated safety analysis and also an environmental report. So under the ISA, integrated safety analysis, there are a lot of components in what sort, how do you safely enrich uranium? So it's a whole array of a series of process hazard analysis that's being conducted. And what if scenarios, what if this happens, what if that happens? So a lot of those are being used, right, to identify the risks, to find mitigations, and make sure that you can do this enrichment safely and responsibly.
And one of the things that has kind of slowed down the development of HALEU is the need to have facilities that can ensure prevention of criticality. And of course, it's a little bit more challenging with higher enrichments than it is with lower enrichments. Another piece of it is transporting the material from one place to another. What kinds of provisions are you looking at with your facilities? How are you going to handle those kinds of challenges?
Right. Indeed, transport is a big thing. So we are taking a kind of a holistic approach. We have a sister company or a partner company called Nano Nuclear Energy. And we have decided early on to basically build a vertically integrated company with these two companies together. So if you look at the nuclear fuel cycle, it all starts with mining and milling, right? And then after that comes conversion, followed by enrichment and then deconversion. So we are teaming up with Nano Nuclear Energy. They're going to take, besides their main business is developing modular micro reactors or MMRs, but they are also getting into this fuel supply chain where they have deep contact in the mining industry. And they are literally setting up contract with miners, mining companies, and also with conversion, developing at the conversion capability in the US, but even offshore. So they're gonna look at that whole front end of the fuel supply chain. And then at the end of the day, the goal, the mission, the vision is to get our feedstock from nanonuclear energy at some discount. And then we will do the enrichment as well as the deconversion. And we can do that at a very, very cost competitive price compared to any other enricher. But Nano also has a company called Advanced Fuel Transportation. So they are, and they have the rights then to transport HALEU and even LEU or LEU plus across the country. So they are working on that package, and we will be working with Nano then, but they will be doing the transportation for LIST.
Now, your technology, the Chrysler laser enrichment, still needs the uranium in the form of UF6 to do its job. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you
Yeah,
still
it
need
has to
something
be.
gaseous and it flows as a gas inside
Yep.
your system. Okay.
Yeah, and there's two laser enrichment processes. The two main categories is ablative, and then which uses uranium metal as your feed, or you need the endless processes like Chrysler, needs UF6 as in a gaseous form. So with ablative, the uranium is in a metal form. You have to use very high heat and electron guns to evaporate that uranium off the metal form. The problem with that is the vapor pressure is extremely low, and therefore that alone doesn't really make the ablative process scalable. So that's one of the problems. And then the second problem with ablative is that the heat involved is that gas is so hot. Those uranium ions are extremely hot, and their collector plate just cannot handle that heat. It corrodes viciously. So in the US, they spent several billion dollars, I believe $2.2 billion on ablatives. And although the technology readiness level was quite high, 6 and 7, they were never able to commercialize that. And then all the emphasis switched back to MLIS. With MLIS, you can use either a 16-micron laser beam or a 5-micron laser. The goal is to use your laser beam such that you can tune the wavelength so it will selectively excite only uranium-235. That's the beauty of laser enrichment, is you only target the one isotope you want. So it's very cost much more cost effective than with centrifuge. You have to spin all the gas, right? With laser enrichment, you target only uranium-235, which is 0.7% of your total mix. Now, the 60-micron architecture, again, this is one of the things they've been trying to develop, trying to scale for the last 55 years. And no one has really been able to fully scale that and make a, you know, and take that all the way to commercialization. We moved away from 16-micron because I personally have been involved in that industry for 20 years. I've seen what works. I've seen what doesn't work. We're using a 5-micron architecture that uses carbon monoxide lasers, and these lasers are indeed much more scalable. It's a totally different type of laser. In fact, it's a type of laser that, as I mentioned earlier, that's being used in the automotive industry for sheet metal cutting, welding, and drilling. Those type of lasers has been around for decades. So we are
So
tapping into that sort
so
of laser technology.
your supply chain is much more capable, 5 microns rather than 16 microns. Is that correct?
Correct. Those type of lasers are much more robust, much more reliable. They are scalable. We do not plan to buy these lasers. You can't really buy a CO laser off the shelf. There are laser companies that sell CO lasers, but it's not really suitable for us. So what we are doing is we are working with contractors to develop our own LIST-owned next generation CO laser. So we've got that going with laser contractors. In the meantime, we're using the legacy lasers, the old 40-year-old lasers that we brought back to life. They're actually working now better than they've ever worked before. That's what we're going to use in our phase one of our program. But in phase our phase two is about scaling. And so we are working on a scaled laser that we later then will industrialize and use that for our commercial facility.
Well, you talked about your phase one is essentially pulling your old lasers, and I guess you have mostly other new equipment other than lasers. And you mentioned to me in a different conversation that back when Jeff Erkins was doing his work, it took days to get any results back if you did a run. And you're being able to measure almost on an instant, minute by second or second by second basis. Tell me a little bit about that, a change in technology, and how does it enable you to do things faster?
Right. Yeah, this is the difference between bulk measurements versus in situ measurements, right? So back in the day, they did not use in situ measurements. What they did 30 years ago is they would collect a enriched sample and then send it away for analysis, right? And they send it in the case of crystal, they send that to three different analytical houses that would analyze those, and it would take 6 to 8 weeks for those results to come back. Now, it's nearly impossible to optimize any process with that kind of turnaround. With this latest technology, these mass spectrometers, it does that instantaneously. In fact, a time-of-flight mass spec, for instance, can take 60,000 mass spectra per second, and it averages that. So within 1 second, you get a very good average signal, and that's sort of with a 1 second turnaround, you can certainly optimize a lot of different parameters. Laser enrichment is a multivariate process, a lot of variables, and that's why we need this rapid turnaround for us to optimize. And that's the goal of our phase one, is to not only get back to baseline, get back to at least what they achieved back in the 90s, but to also optimize that. We believe that there's room for optimization. It can go even better. And then we want to show that we can do LEU and HALEU in phase one.
When you talk about the process of optimization, I envision somebody moving a lot of dials and knobs and having to really understand exactly what they're doing with that. But I also envision a automated bot, an AI, being able to do that kind of stuff much more quickly than a human person. Are you guys developing AI tools to run your process?
Not really. The thing is, with AI, we try to stay away from any of those tools or even off the internet. This is a sensitive nuclear technology, and we have to protect it. So we don't really want to use any of those tools that can. We rather use a process called DOE, the design of experiments, where you can basically select different variables and decide which ones to adjust and relatively quickly get to an optimum value. But yeah, we do not want to use, get this information and our experimental procedures out on the internet.
I can understand that. Okay, so phase two, what happens in phase two?
So phase two is all about scaling. And we are running phase two in parallel with phase one. It's going to extend. Phase one runs about 2 years duration. Phase two is an extra 2 years, but we already used the first 2 years as well. So it's a 4 year in total program to scale lasers, scale our separators, and scale our gas handling systems. So that's what we do in phase two. And then we want to show also that we can do both LEU in one stage and HALEU in two stages using this scaled and industrialized equipment. So that's what we do in phase two. And again, this is all under a state of Tennessee radiological material license. Then comes phase three. Phase three now is about preparing for a commercial facility. I'm not sure if I mentioned this before, but yes, LIS Technologies, we did buy, we did a site selection. We literally bought an island here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's actually a peninsula, but it's almost completely surrounded by water, except for the top end, like an umbilical cord almost. This island is, it used to be called Duct Island, but we rebranded that to List Island. It's 206 acres, and we are preparing to build a 5 million SWU per year enrichment facility. Now, SWU, what is it? A SWU stands for Separative Work Units. It is the effort required to enrich uranium. And we're going to build a 5 million SWU. Now, 5 million SWU is pretty big. I mean, there's only one enrichment plant in the US. It's run by a European consortium of British, Dutch, and German companies. It's called Urenco. And their plan, I believe, is something like 4.5 million swoop a year. And that's the only capability the US currently have. That supply that we currently have is only serves about one third of our annual needs. So we have to import two thirds of our enriched uranium from Europe and from Russia. Now, that's just we only produce one third of our current needs. If you look at the next 25 years, right, President Trump made this pledge that we're going to quadruple nuclear power over the next 25 years. That means we have to build four times as many reactors over the next 25 years, and they all need enriched uranium, right, fuel. So if we want to become fully self-sufficient, we have to first bring up our own production at that factor three in the beginning, as of today, plus the factor four over the next 25 years. So enrichment capacity has to increase by about 12x over the next 25 years, so we can become fully self-sufficient, fully energy independent, and this is more than just energy security. It's energy security, but it's also for national security purposes that we need to become self-sufficient. And it's not just enrichment, it's the entire fuel supply chain, right? We currently only mine 2% of our annual needs in the US. The other 98% is all imported uranium, raw uranium from other countries. So the mining industry has to step up. That can take a decade or longer for just for one mine to get back online. And once you mine and mill and you produce yellowcake conversion, there's only three companies in the world that does conversion, converting from yellowcake to UF6 gas. One of those companies is in the US, but they are they need we need much more capacity than that over the next 25 years. That needs to scale up at least 8x if we want to meet our future supply of and future feedstock of UF6. Then
Yeah,
comes enrichment, 12x increase.
conversion was another industry that got slammed pretty hard by the import of Russian enriched uranium, because as I recall, it wasn't very long ago, maybe half a decade ago, that the facility in Metropolis was actually shut down because the price was so low for conversion that they said, it's not worth running the plant.
Right. Yep. Exactly. And now they are coming back online. They plan to increase their capacity, but that plan increase is nowhere near enough to you know, they need to basically increase their capacity by 8x. There's some new companies coming online. I mean, NANO Nuclear Energy is planning to get into that space. So they have plans. I believe just last week there was another announcement of a company that's going to get into conversion. So that's welcome news. Of course, if you look at UF6, there's also the DOE has stockpiles, hundreds and thousands of tons of depleted UF6. So these are the tailings or the waste almost of previous enrichment processes dating back 80 years, right? All of those tailings have been put in storage, and it's now it's concentrated or located. One of them is in Paducah, Kentucky, and the other one I believe is in Piketon, Ohio. So all that depleted UF6, so it's down from the 0.7%. It's been stripped down to those tailings are around. You get some of them at 0.4%. Those are the high assay tailings, but there's a lot at 0.3% or 0.2%. So as a last resort, one can, especially with lasers has the potential to take those tailings and remove some of that 235 and then enrich it. And that's exactly what GLE is doing in Paducah, Kentucky, with their PLEF, Paducah Laser Enrichment Facility. But they're only using 200,000 tons out of 1 million tons of depleted UF6. So there's still a lot left that this technology could potentially use. But we would prefer to start with natural uranium at 0.7%.
Yeah, I saw just yesterday that GLE had announced an investment of maybe $1.75 billion, or a planned investment, I guess, in a facility to do that.
Correct. That's what it's going to, that's the capital cost to build that facility. We announced 1.37 billion. I think we will come well less than GLE. And then you also have to look at the operating costs, right? I think if you look at the overall cost structure, you typically measure that in terms of the dollars per SWU. How much dollars per sewer is it for capital expenditure, and how much dollars per sewer for operating expenditure? GLE is around the 60, at least $60 per sewer. And this technology is very cost competitive with that. We can probably do that at half of that, $30 per sewer. So we've done detailed calculations. So we are able to offer significant discounts once we start producing this type of fuel.
What is the current market price for a swoop?
Oh,
I know it changes regularly.
Yeah, that's exactly. I knew there was something I wanted to say. This is it. The current market price, this is the long-term price and the spot price, right? The current spot price, I believe, is now $200 per swoop. It was 203 a month ago. It's down to $200 per swoop. And in 2018 or 19, this was down to like $40 per sewer. That's why ConverDyn couldn't, you know, and even the conversion price, they all had a price tag to it. It was just not possible to either convert or enrich at that point. But now it has gone through the roof. It's at an all-time high, right? The spot price around $200 per sewer for your enrichment services, and the long-term price or the term price is around $173 per sewer. So that's well above the 30 our production costs and you know capex and opex of $30 per sewer.
One of the things that happened to drive prices as low as they were for enrichment is that once you get centrifuges up and spinning, the owners of those machines are very reluctant to turn them off or even slow them down. They can't slow them down, I guess, and if they turn them off, it's hard to get them restarted. Is your system as momentum dependent as a centrifuge? In other words, can you, if the prices on the market get low enough, can you just say, well, we're not going to do any enrichment until you want to bid the prices higher?
Very good point. Indeed, that's another beauty of laser enrichment. It's like a lamp, like a light switch. You can turn it on and off easily, right, with a flick of a switch. With centrifuges, you cannot turn down those centrifuges because to start them up or to slow them down, it goes through these resonances. And resonances can literally destroy those centrifuges. So that's why they need a stable grid, very stable. They cannot afford to lose power. And yeah, once they turn on, they have to stay on for their entire lifetime.
It's not good to be a commodity producer when you can't slow your production, because that means it's overwhelm your customers and drive your prices to uneconomic levels.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, that's the beauty. Laser enrichment has so many. It's been the laser enrichment is considered the holy grail of all these enrichment technologies, right? And just to give you an overview of what are these different uranium enrichment technologies. Well, the first technology used in the Manhattan Project in the 1940s was they used diffusion technology, membranes through which the UF6 gas was forced or pumped through. But very inefficient. The enrichment factor, something like 1.005, extremely low. So they needed thousands and thousands of pumps. And it was done in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, right here at the K25 site. And in fact, our building is a mile away from the K25 site. We're right on that site. But that's your first generation enrichment technology. And that was, it took 50 years for centrifuges to fully replace the diffusion enrichment technology. So centrifuges are now the only uranium enrichment plants in the world. Everyone, all the nations use them. The U.S. has only one. But laser enrichment has been around for, you know, since the early 70s, and it's considered the holy grail. It's the third generation technology, but no one has been able to commercialize that. So there's a lot of anticipation that, you know, someone will eventually get this to work. And if both us and Jilly are successful, I'll be very happy, because this pie is big enough. The demand, there's no way we're going to be able to increase our current enrichment capacity by 12x. One company alone is not going to be able to do that, right? We all need to be successful. So that's why we have a much more collaborative spirit than a competitive spirit.
Now, you mentioned that you spent 8 years at GLE during your career path. Do you still have contact or communications with some of your former colleagues, or are you guys just happy to cheer each other on from afar?
Yeah, there's no hard feelings between us, but we do, you know, because that is a classified technology And ours is not yet classified. It's pending. We are preparing for to become classified, because once we demonstrate that we can produce practical quantities of enriched uranium, we will become classified. So because of that, we are keeping a bit of a distance between us. It's just for their own sake and for our own sake that we do not discuss the, we do socially, occasionally I do hang out with some of them, but other than that, we never talk work at all. I've got no idea really what's happening there, and they have no idea what we're doing.
Well, that's the beauty of working in a classified environment. I never had to talk about my job with my wife when I was
Right.
still working in a classified environment. As you guys progressed, again, I knew you guys when you had no resources and no money, just a really cool idea. How did you move from that? What happened to make it so that you guys were able to start recovering this technology and then start building a company around it?
Once we realized the potential of this technology, and we became aware of the excellent results that were achieved in the early 90s, those results weren't exactly shared with Jeff Erkin in the early 90s. They were only shared with Jeff in 2019. And as the guy, the chief scientist that worked on that program wrote, he said that he believed it was time that Jeff Erkin's, he wanted Jeff Erkin to know that that technology worked much better than he could have ever imagined. So that was an eye-opener for Jeff. Very happy that it works. He's been saying that all along, but also very kind of sad that it took so long for them to actually inform him that, of how well it worked. So, and at that point, I was already working with Jeff Erkins to revive the CRISLA process, right? But once we got confirmation that it works very well, we formed a company, CRISLA Inc. And the exclusive goal of CRISLA Inc. back then was to find a financial partner, someone that can walk with us and develop this technology, bring it back to life, and eventually commercialize that. So we had discussions with all sorts of entities, but eventually through the HALEU Consortium, the DOE's HALEU Consortium, that put us in contact with a lot of other people in the HALEU fuel industry. I started contacting some of those participants, and my paths crossed that of JU. JU is a nuclear entrepreneur. He's a Wall Street guru, and he's a capital markets specialist. And he did his due diligence, and they saw the potential. He's the founder of NANO Nuclear Energy. He saw the potential of this CRISLA technology. And he also saw the synergy with NANO Nuclear Energy. So he decided to invest into this technology. We formed a new entity, a new company called LIS Technologies, and we transferred all the assets from CRISLA Inc. to LIS Technologies. And also CRISLA Inc. had intellectual property. So we transferred all the patents as well to LIS Technologies. So JU and I are the two co-founders together with Jeff Erkin. He's still alive. He's 94 years old, but he's still alive, and he's one of our consultants. But JU and I are tied at the hip. He manages our New York office that handles, all our PR, our marketing, our finances, our investors, legal. All of that is handled at the head office in Lower Manhattan in New York City, and then I handle the technical development here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. But yeah, it's been a very good partnership with JU. LIS Technologies is a separate company from NANO, because we're going to go classified. NANO do not want to be also become classified, or they want to be separate and work in the unclassified world. But it's going well. We just announced another raise that we closed. We've raised now in total $71 million. We've got big plans for the year ahead that I cannot really talk about right now.
And that's the way finance works. There's quiet periods and things that you just can't talk about until they happen. Now you guys are going to build your own lasers. You got a plot of land already for your facility. You're working on your license application. You've got your phase one demonstrations going. Can you give us a little bit of a timeline for when you think your 5 million SWU facility might be up and running and contributing to the inventory of enriched uranium in the US?
Right. Yep, as I mentioned earlier, there's four phases. I only explained the first three phases, right? Getting back to baseline, redemonstrating the old technology in phase one. Phase two is scaling. Phase three is preparing for this commercial facility and actually constructing a commercial facility. Phase four is actually being in production. So the goal here is to be in production. First, we're going to build a pilot plant, just 500,000 swoop a year, because we need to make that transition from laboratory to a semi-commercial, entity. So we're going to build this 500,000 swoop pilot plant by the end of this decade. Then we're going to build the main commercial facility, the 5 million swoop. First, in two stages. First, 2.5 million swoop by the end of 2032, we will be operationally ready, and then another 2.5 million by the end of 2033. Sorry, tw end of 2031 and the end of 2033. So by the end of 2033, we'll be fully operationally ready with a 5 million SWU. And then we're going to go back with this pilot plant and repurpose that as a HALEU facility. We're going to design it initially as a HALEU facility, but use it only for LEU and LEU plus. But later on, we will repurpose that for to produce HALEU. But all happening in the early 2030s. That's essentially when, coming online with all the SMRs need their advanced fuel.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier on in the conversation that you've got some synergies with nanonuclear. I presume, I'm pretty sure, nanonuclear is going to need some HALEU of its own. Is that correct?
Yes, that is exactly the synergy with them, is that they need HALEU. In fact, if you talk to, and we talk to all these big SMR companies, right? If you talk to them, they say that their biggest risk is the availability of HALEU. That supply chain for them is their biggest risk. They've got no other big risk than nuclear fuel. Our supply chain risk is just UF6 gas, right? So we've got steps and activities to mitigate that. But for them, it is the availability of HALEU. And they were all going to depend, they were all depending on Russian HALEU, right? But then, since we have decided no more, nothing more from Russia, except through the wafer program, a little bit more imports from Russia, but no more HALEU from Russia. So they are now forced to look at other avenues. You get the big tech companies, they all are very supportive of all these SMR companies, right? You see Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Meta signing power purchase agreements with SMR companies. But what's lacking is that they don't look deeper down into this fuel supply chain. They're starting to do that now. But what we really need is from the big tech to also realize that these SMR companies do have risks, specifically with HALEU, and that so we're hoping that they will start investing also in the fuel supply chain and doing fuel purchase agreements, not just power purchase agreements.
My ears perked when you made that list because I've been an Apple guy for a long time. I haven't seen anything about Apple being interested in SMRs. All the others, yes, but I've got to go back and look. Maybe you've just taught me something new because
Yeah, I think
of the Mag
Apple.
7, I think they're always the one that I'd say, where are these guys?
Right. Yeah, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Meta. So Apple, I presume Apple does have big data centers. We haven't spoken to Apple. We are starting to talk to some of
Yeah.
the others, but
Well,
I assume
Apple's
Apple
got
will
big
have.
data centers, but they claim that they're already fully clean by wind and solar. But anyway, I'm going to look that up. I'll leave
Right.
that not for you, but for a lookup for me.
And that's what makes nuclear power so attractive to these data center companies, right? Because nuclear is resilient. It is available 24/7. Wind is not available 24/7, neither is solar. So they are gravitating literally towards nuclear power, and especially small modular reactors or micro reactors. Because as the data center grows, the small modular reactor can also grow, right? It's modular. So that can also expand with the data center. And it's interesting with LIS Technologies, our involvement with, if you look at our involvement with AI, where we were basically indirectly, we are involved, first of all, supplying the nuclear fuel for these SMR companies, right, in the future, so that they can pay, so they can power up those data centers. But if you look at the AI, also need chips of obviously advanced semiconductor chips, right? Where do those chips come from? Well, they come from companies like TSMC, or actually, no, it starts with NVIDIA. NVIDIA makes these big AI chips, They supply OpenAI, they supply the Cerebras, those companies with these wafer scale engines, right? But where does NVIDIA get the individual chips from? There's only one company, and that comes from TSMC, Taiwan. Taiwan produces 80% of the world's chip. Taiwan supplies to all sorts of companies, including Intel and Apple. It's a supply to NVIDIA. But the machines, what machines does TSMC use? Well, those machines all come from ASML. ASML has the world monopoly in making the EUV. EUV stands for extreme ultraviolet. So these EUV machines are made by ASML. One of those machines costs $400 million, and it consists of many lasers that basically produces this extreme ultraviolet light to make those chips. The process is called photolithography. LIS Technologies has its roots in ASML because several of my folks, including myself, spent years at ASML helping to perfect that technology, but also learning an awful lot on those industrial laser systems that's being used. And that's why we are bringing a lot of ASML expertise and know-how to LIS Technologies. So from that perspective, through ASML, we also have kind of have a little bit of a contribution towards AI data centers in general.
Yeah, I sure hope that your lasers don't cost $400 million or
No,
your
not at
machine.
all. But those are big laser systems. Ours,
Yeah.
one of our lasers will just be a fraction of that. But yes, we will have many different lasers as well, for production facility. So at the end of the day, it will become a $1.37 billion facility with many lasers in there.
In rough numbers, how big is your 5 million school building going to have to be? I mean, obviously, people, or not obviously, but some people remember just how huge the enrichment facilities have been over the years, back when gaseous
Right.
diffusion, I think the buildings were like a mile long, half a
Yes.
mile wide or something. How big is your
Right.
facility going to be?
Well, let me say, first of all, that's the proliferation concern. There's a perception that laser enrichment can be done so efficiently that you can do that in the basement of your house. But that's not entirely true because you need a lot of support systems. So the diffusion technology, the Manhattan Project building at the K25 site was something like 74 acres big. At the time, it was the world's biggest building under one roof. It eclipsed the Pentagon. Laser enrichment, our facility, we are planning roughly a 6 to 8 acre facility on List Island, which is 200 acres big. So roughly 6 to 8 acres will be our building, the size of about 6 football fields.
All right. Christo, it's been a tremendous and informative conversation. I'd like to offer you the opportunity. Is there any specific topics that you'd like to share with the audience that we haven't covered?
Yeah, let me spend a minute quickly just talking about our humble origins, right? And it all starts before the Second World War. The inventor of our technologies is Jeff Eerkens. He was born, he's Dutch, but he was born in Indonesia. And back in the day, Indonesia was called the Dutch East Indies. It was a Dutch colony. So born there in 1933, and then the Second World War broke out, and the Japanese took over those Pacific islands. And Jeff Eerkens and his family and all his compatriots were all taken into custody and put into Japanese concentration camps. So Jeff Eerkens spent 3 years in a Japanese concentration camp at the age of 10, 11, and 12. Brutal conditions. Many of them perished. That was in 1943. And then in 1945, they were saved by the Allies. They came and saved them. And he learned later that there was this new weapon developed where they utilized the power of the atom that helped save his life. And he became enthralled by that. He wanted to know, learn all about nuclear power. At the age of 20, he moved to the US and he studied at Berkeley, California, and he studied nuclear engineering and later got into laser enrichment and he became the father of laser enrichment. Now, the irony is now, we are developing his technology at the very same site. We're a mile away from that site, the very site that helped save his life. So this is why this Oak Ridge and this specific location is so special to us, because it's literally a full circle for Jeff Eerkens.
That's a great story. I'm happy that Jeff is still alive to see what you guys are doing with the technology that he incubated and then had to work really hard to kind of keep the embers glowing long enough to find somebody like you to bring it to life again. I'm
Right.
fascinated, and of course, as a longtime supporter of advanced nuclear technologies, I think it's terrific to hear that there are some solutions to the often talked about problem of supplying adequate amounts of HALEU. I know that many of the advanced reactor companies have figured out ways to get started with lower enrichments, but many of them, most of them, still want higher enrichments to improve the performance and longevity of their system. Guys, keep it up.
Thank you, Rod. And thank you also for your contributions in the whole nuclear industry. And it was great to see you in that documentary called Nuclear Now. I really enjoyed that documentary. But yeah, thank you for your support.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Take care. Have a great
Thank
day.
you, Rod. Take care. Bye.
There's a way, such a better way today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.